waited my entire life for this. The world's gonna start over. I'ma burn it all.
What happens now determines what happens to the rest of the world.
Yo, this Black Panther release is a huge deal. A huge deal. I don't know if you guys have been living under a rock, but Marvel is about to release its first black superhero. Well, you had Storm, but she wasn't the star of the X-Men movie, Marsha. But
no, she wasn't.
But you have Black Panther, man. He is the Prince of Wakanda.
Yeah.
And this is about to be a big deal.
I like how you said that. Wakanda.
Yes, play by Chadwick Boseman. Actually, right now, I'm looking at, this is pretty spontaneous, I'm looking at an interview on SiriusXM where he's brought to tears talking about how much this movie really means to him. Check it out.
You know, they're two little kids, Ian and Taylor, who recently passed from cancer. And throughout our filming, I was communicating with them, knowing that they were both terminal.
He goes on to say that they tried to stay alive long enough to see the film.
Oh.
Two African-American kids.
Oh my gosh.
And it made me think about a professor of mine. She's an anthropology professor, works at SIUE, and she, I don't want to say her name because I didn't get her permission to tell this story necessarily, but let me go to it. She put up this status about her son talking about how he wishes he was white. And she said, why? He said, well, all of the superheroes get to be white. You know, you've got, she started naming all of the superheroes. You got Superman, you got Batman. You know, I want to be a superhero too.
Avenger. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you go on and on and on. He said, Mama, I wish I was white. They get to have all of the adventures.
Wow.
And, you know, she said it hurt her heart. Now, if you know her, she was one of the people that helped to shape my consciousness. And as I started reading this, you know, I was almost brought to tears thinking about it because my parents didn't let my sisters play with certain Barbie dolls because it wasn't just a race thing. It wasn't just about representation, but he also didn't want them to have to aspire to an unrealistic body type or whatever that may be. So he wanted them to get dolls that look like them. And the same with me. I love Transformers now and only play with Transformers as a kid because these were machines. There was no racial undertone. So I could play with them and there was nothing I would have to try to aspire to be, right?
Interesting.
So now with Black Panther, we have an opportunity to see a version of ourselves, see diverse superheroes, even in this realm, in this galaxy. Wakanda is not a real country, but it has real implications about what this
means. And that's one good reason why this film is important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So today on Shopedia, Marsha and I are talking about Black Panther, and it goes into this genre that a lot of people don't know about, but it's good to shed light on it, Afrofuturism.
Yeah.
Which is basically black sci-fi.
And, you know, a lot of people was probably wondering, like, why is everyone making a big deal out of this film? Why is it such a huge deal? Okay, it's just another superhero. But this isn't just any superhero.
Not at all. Not at all. Not at all. This is the Prince of Wakanda. You're listening to Shopedia. Let's get it. That, of course, is Marsha. I'm your host, Doma T, one half of the Shopedia team. Appreciate y'all for tuning in. Today, we are talking about Black Panther. We're talking about Afrofuturism. Going to go into Valentine's Day and a special Valentine's Day had by Marsha, who had a chance to interview an R&B legend. Gonna
I guess
dive
we could
that.
Call him a legend, right?
We call
you
him
know,
a legend.
We've that been word really is very questionable. I have to be very picky with how I use that word. I have to be careful because everyone does not deserve to be called a legend, I guess.
That is true.
So
that is
true.
You
have to be careful.
That is true. But I think Case is a legend. I give him legendary status. A legend in a lot of circles, at least. We'll do that.
Okay.
And then we're also going to talk about the Obama presidential portraits. The first time that two African-American artists had a chance to paint these portraits. We're going to highlight them. We're going to go into why these portraits by Amy Shepard and Kehinde were so controversial and why everyone is talking about it. And find out from art expert Pat Keenan, what she thought about him, and kind of give us some background about these artists and their work, and why we shouldn't be surprised about them going the direction they went. But right now,
that's right.
It's all about.
And since this is Black History Month, uh-huh. there's a lot of firsts happening this month. There's a lot of firsts.
Yeah, it's
true.
With
the S at the end.
Right, several of them.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that.
Yeah, we're going to dive into all of that. You're listening to Shopedia. Well, first off, I want to dive into this concept of Afrofuturism and what it really is. Now, as a professor that I had the opportunity to learn under, he became a friend, a mentor. It feels almost, it feels odd just calling him my professor because this is like my older brother. His name is Dr. Ramsey. He's the head of the Black Studies Department. And he had a chance to call in this morning. I thought he would be teaching class, but he snuck out and hollered at us, man. Thank you. Thank you for hollering at us, Ramsey.
Oh, no problem. Always any chance to get up with you. I mean, I think I can skip class for that.
I wish you would have let me do that back in the day.
I know.
So I took this class with Dr. Ramsey on Afrofuturism, and I'm just going to be honest. I actually signed up for it just because anything that Ramsey was teaching was interesting.
Wow.
I had no idea what Afrofuturism was. But now it's all the craze. What is Afrofuturism?
Well, actually in the early 90s or mid-90s, a guy named Mark Derry actually first just, you know, he threw the term out just in an essay. But then in the late 90s where there was a scholar, her name is Alondra Nelson, she's actually now the president of Social Research Council, and she just started a discussion group. Boy, this is back in the day, though. This was like Yahoo had these discussion groups that people would have, like a listserv, and she just... It was on Afrofuturism, and she was really trying to figure out, hey, what do we use as a critical framework to talk about Black people and technology? It's crucial to say this, too. It was she started at the late 90s, like 1999, because, you know, everyone was concerned about Y2K. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that, Margo, but anyway.
Marsha says she is.
Y2K.
Yeah, and so it was, people were really worried about that. They were just trying to say, hey, how do we describe all that Black people are doing with technology, whether that's in science fiction, but also they're saying, hey, what does it mean that all these DJs are working with machines and things like that? So that's how, like, Afrofuturism early on was just the kind of critical framework to describe all of the things. And then it has evolved now today, I think, when people see Black people and technology, they just say, oh, that's Afrofuturism, you know? So I think it's really kind of the evolution of the term when we think of it now.
What makes it so interesting to me is that was Afrofuturism such an interest because there was this idea that Black people didn't really care about sci-fi and this was kind of a way to, I don't know, kind of combat that and say, no, we live in this space.
Yeah, exactly. It was. There was another phrase at the time, too, and that's where at least Elizabeth Nelson was combating this idea. There were some people talking about the digital divide, and they kind of suggested, hey, there are these people over here who do things with technology, and there are these people over here, includes a large number of African-Americans, who don't do anything with technology. And so Afrofuturism, a way of saying, yeah, they do. It's not always in the ways you think of technology in a formal way. People have actually been doing things with technical things and machinery just forever. And so that's why, and it's always had a sci-fi element to it. Like, I mean, you think about beatboxing, you think about these dances. It was no coincidence they would call this dance the robot, all of those kinds of things. So moonwalk, say, like, wow. From my perspective, I'd say somebody who's thinking about the world through an Afrofuturist lens would identify those things. And they're like, yeah, what is that? Why are Blacks doing all these things with technology, even in some ways that we wouldn't even classify? Like I say, just, yeah, the whole of breakdancing, so much of it was about music, too, and particularly rap music.
I think about the, like George Clinton and the funk era, how they used to dress.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, the mothership and all that. So it goes way back, right? People talk, I mean, you know, we can even go back further and talk about the spirituals, you know. It was so odd that these people who were enslaved were talking about, hey, you know, swing low, sweet chariot, come in the same. You know, it was all of these things. And the myth of the flying Africans saying, hey, we're going to fly back to Africa. So, yeah, if you look this throughout history, it's always been a sci-fi element there with Blacks imagining all kinds of possibilities.
Mm.
So when we think about Black Panther now and Stan Lee, what was he drawing on when he created this character that was this African prince that, you know, came from this world, had these powers and this and created this whole world that black people so closely identify with, even though it wasn't created by a black person.
I know, yeah. At the time,
it wasn't.
Two things were happening. Oh, no. Nah, so Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were the ones who created Black Panther. You know, the fascinating thing is that they created it in 1966. And I say that's fascinating because that's when the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense was
So created. Who came first?
And boy. You know what? It's hard to say because they were in the same year, but they did. They weren't aware of each other. Like, I can guarantee you that Stan Lee, they were not, like, hanging out in Oakland saying, hey, let's do some organizing. And the Black Panthers were not necessarily looking at comic books like that. You know, they got their logo from a group, an organizing group in Alabama. So I think it just, you know how things just happen at the same time. People just doing, you know, just remixing ideas and images, and that came together.
So just
another reason that.
Just to kill that, a lot of people probably was thinking that this movie, Black Panther, had something to do with the Black Panther movement. I mean, but it's not. They have nothing to do with it.
No. They're totally separate. In fact, at one point, Marvel, when they were doing Black Panther, they were nervous that people from the Black Panther Party might, you know, have some problems with them also having the Black Panther. So they even started calling Black Panther different names, you know. He was a kind of White Panther. He was other things. But then they came back to the idea of Black Panther. But, yeah, so it was, yeah, they were very different. But, of course, I think in, like, black spaces, those terms circulate in all kind of, you know, overlapping and interesting ways. So
I'm not a huge comic fan. I'm trying, though. I went to my first Comic-Con last year, so I'm learning.
Oh.
So this is the first. So this is the first unveiling of, the Black Panther. Like, I know he's been in the films before, correct? Mm-hmm. But they never really put a spotlight on the Black Panther. Am I correct?
Yeah, he was in one of those Civil War movies. Yeah, you're right. The Marvel Civil War. He just showed up. I mean, he had a supporting role. But yeah, this would be the first time he has his own kind of.
So we never really knew who the Black Panther was. We never knew the backstory for him, basically.
Yeah, I would say on public scene, we didn't know who he was. But if you've been reading comics for a while, he's always had solo comics. So going back, going back to 66. So we talking about. And in fact, in the comic world, before it was even known they were going to do a movie, they've been doing these special issues in 2016, all these kind of special 50-year anniversary. Yeah, he's like 52 now. So he's been around for a while. And, you know, different people. First, though, it was white comic book writers and artists who were drawing him. And then it was much later that they had black people who started drawing and telling the story of Black Panther. So, yeah, it was very fascinating.
Ramsey, walk us back through. You started to talk about Stan Lee and Jack Kirby doing this in 1966,
yeah.
And how, in a lot of ways, that was that. What was the climate like? Was that revolutionary, or was it just a way to reimagine a new character? Because, I mean, you know, soon after that, a few years after that, you had black exploitation films and the idea of a black superhero like Shaft or a problematic one like Superfly will become, you know, part of American pop culture. But what did it mean for them to create this comic book in 66 at the time?
Yeah, for them, though, like the time when they were doing this Marvel comics, they were, you know, they were doing far out, all kind of crazy things for heroes anyway. And so for them, in their world, they were like trying to imagine people going to space. They were trying to imagine people using various kinds of sciences and technology in the comic books. And they were hoping Stan Lee was out here. He'd go to California and advocate, hey, can we do movies on this and television shows? But he was having a hard time making it happen. But in the comic books themselves, they could just say, hey, it's a medium. We can imagine this, you know, farthest thing out as possible. So for him, they say, hey, let's create this African continent. This country that's never been touched by outside influence. They technologically advanced. So I think it probably, on the one hand, this might disappoint people. It wasn't that far out in terms of the visions they've always done. They were doing crazy things in a good way. Anyway, but of course, you know, when that meant something to black people, and it meant something to, I think, black people in a way that it could mean to people who weren't, you know, thinking about it. So that was a good thing and an exciting thing for us that they were like, oh, wow. And then, you know, over the years, folks started saying, oh, well, an African nation that hasn't been touched by, you know, your outside influences, not been conquered by Europeans. That meant a whole lot to, you know, us today and even then and over the years. So it was really important to have it like that. And then to now that we can have a film on that, I think that, yeah, that kind of stretched out in all different kind of ways. But I never forget, though. It never leaves my mind, hey, this was created, though, by a couple of white guys. So.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting to me. And then there's this idea, it ties to a better kind of like this thread of what it means to literature, like, and how many writers are interested in comics. And like, I think about Ta-Nehisi Coates, and I actually found out about this from your page first, when Ta-Nehisi is writing a comic as well. He's the author of Between the World and Me, and after that, what was it? We Were 8 Years in Power, which I'm right now getting through. And we had a chance to meet him. Actually, Ramsey introduced me to Coates way back when he wrote his memoir, Beautiful Struggle, his first book. Talk about what his space and kind of like this space of black intellects who are interested in this comic world, even as we think about Boondocks, which has Afrofuturism elements with Huey Freeman doing karate and all of this.
I think it was a whole generation, and it continued, of African-American men in particular, and many of them became rappers, and some became, you know, writers like Ta-Nehisi and the novelist Colson Whitehead and Matt Johnson. And then they were all, like, comic books was just something that was around. And they said, oh, wow, this is very interesting. Like, let's think about this. And so I think that when we think about, and you think about, let's see, some rappers like MF Doom, right? Who's clearly going off of the character Doom in the comic books. And then think about Wu-Tang, who's looking at these martial art films. So I think
Wu-Tang,
all of these kind of pop culture things were kind of get to people. And they were, like, very interested and fascinated with those kinds of cultural issues. And so it kind of, I think that's just what it added to what they did. But for Coates, he's always said that. He said the two things really kind of shaped him as a writer was, one, rap music, and then two, comic books. And you see how they both mixed it, because in some ways, rapping is like all, you know, I mean, I know it's all about, hey, keeping it real, but in many ways, it's very imaginative, and, hey, I'm this bad, and I can fly over here and do all of that. So it's very superhero kind of stuff, right? So, yeah, so I think it makes sense that those two would be really things that shaped Ta-Nehisi, but just a whole generation of writers, you know? And, but it's true. That was when we met Coates in 2011. That was before he was, like, the coach he is now, right? So, yeah, I always look for that.
Well, so, Professor, why do you think this film is important for us right now? Why do America need this movie more than ever?
Your opinion. I think, one, I mean, it's just some of the struggles that black folks are going through. In particular, you think about the administration. I mean, it seems like every day, every couple of days, there's some new thing that's saying, oh, here's the problem. Well, think about Africa. You know, this notion that Africa is nothing, broken down, and it's just this pitiful place. But now we're going to have a movie tomorrow that's showing Africa in a way when people are imagining that Africa and presenting it. I think that matters to folks. I think another one is just within African-American community, you see issues around colorism, right? And this movie is going to have, like, have you seen how, not people have talked about it, but all of these images of these dark-skinned black women who are, like, playing major roles in this, like, it's going to mean something to people in a way that just telling, you know, when we in front of young people say, oh, everybody's equal, everybody should be valued. But when you see an image on a big screen, it sort of communicates that to you in a way that you can't do it in words. So I think that's another reason that it matters. And anytime I think the attention that gets around a movie that is directed by a black person that has so many black people and it gets this much conversation, I think that makes it matter, because it gives us kind of a central text to talk about. Back in the day when Pongo was my student, we all read Frederick Douglass, the narrative of Frederick Douglass. I think it meant a lot to people when all these groups of young black men and black women, we could say, oh, we've all read this text and we can all talk about it. So I think Black Panther is like, hey, this is going to be a common text that we can get together and read, so to speak. And I think that matters to people, just to have commonality, some common experience.
Okay. And one more question. in the future, how do you think this movie will affect the black community?
Yeah, well, you know, I have mixed feelings in some ways about it, because I sometimes wonder, and I mean, and this is an open question for me, like, how much will trickle down? You know, like, will this movie come out and it just means opportunities for the people who are in it? Or will it mean new opportunities and new ways of imagining? So I wonder if that will happen. But that's just my kind of skepticism as a professor or intellectual. The positive I see is this. Aaron Magruder, day I was at, he talked about his first memory in his life. He said he went to see Star Wars in 1977. And he said, it's not just one of my earliest memories. He said, it is my earliest memory in life. He said, I went with my dad to see Star Wars. Now, he was 3 or 4 when he saw that. And then we see what he went on to do. He was just so inspired artistically by that. So now I'm wondering, God, like, it's going to be a 5 or 6 year old who will walk into Black Panther with their mom or dad, and they're going to just be inspired to do all kind of creative things later. And so that's what I'm really excited about. And not even just a 5 or 6 year old. It's going to be a 30 year old. It's going to be a 40 or 50 year old and say, oh, wow, I saw this and it gives me new possibilities for imagining.
That's
the
what
world.
It's all about. We all need to be inspired. And this is a great time for our culture. Well, so hopefully this film, everyone get out and go check it out and support, support, support. This is for anyone, not just for African Americans. Yeah. You know, I've seen people question, like, is it okay if I go see this film? You know, you think I'll be safe? It's not like that. Yeah. Everyone needs to go out and support.
But I do want to say this, because I think you and Ramsey brought up a good point, too. I think a lot of times we have these high moments in Black culture where we think that a film or something will kind of save our consciousness in a way. And, and it's like, you know, it's going to be a great moment. It's going to inspire amazing people. But at the end of the day, it's by Universal Studios. And those are going to be the big profiteers of that. But then you have, like, you do have this cultural trickle down where I remember after college, working in corporate America, and I had one of my white colleagues say, man, I had on a red tie and a navy blue suit. He was like, you look like the president today. And I know he would never have had that consciousness had Obama not existed. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly.
So it allows the country to reimagine who we are, man. Dr. Ramsey, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you all for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Ramsey.
Talking about it.
Yo, Ramsey is the creator of CulturalFront.org. He's a professor of literature at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. He was one of my professors. He helped to shape who I am as a man, as an individual, and as a thinker. He's also the author of The Black Arts Enterprise. Grab that. It's at libraries across the country. Check out culturalfront.org. And if you search my name in Cultural Front, you'll see some poorly written articles by a college student, but it's still interesting. Still interesting.
Hey, thanks so much, you all.
All right, I'll talk to you, Fess H.
All righty.
So we got to look at the history of Afrofuturism, but now we're going to get a look at actually Black Panther, the film itself, the storyline of it. What is the movie about? Who is this Prince of Wakanda? And right now we have the CEO of Two Guard Media Group, Kevin Ross, who's post about the film, laying out everything you needed to know about this Marvel world they created in that country. Went viral, so we had to get him in here to talk about it face to face. So how you doing, man?
I'm good, man. How are
Welcome
you guys?
To the show.
I'm well. Welcome to Shopee.
Man, thank you for having me. This is crazy. Like, within 24 hours, this is like a radio interview, a blog post down at Clark Atlanta University. One of the professors down there hit me up on Facebook, and it's still trending this morning. I'm at like 8,000 or 7,000 likes and almost 4,000 shares internationally.
So what did you post?
All I posted was, because I'm just a kid, you know, who used to read comic books and get laughed at. You know, I was spending my allowance money going to buy comic books, and I just happened to really, you know, dig them, and I really studied them the same way I studied music. You know, I'm into the music industry. That's really what I do. But I really love comic books, and I just posted what I knew about, you know, the Black Panther, like what I knew as a kid.
Wow.
Because a lot of people were confusing. Some people were confusing the movie with the historic revolutionary group, the Black Panther Party.
Right.
For me, I didn't want for people to confuse the two, because that takes away from what the real Black Panther Party, the you know, the historic group, mm-hmm. what they really achieved. You know, the Black Panther, as much of an achievement as it is and as much of a groundbreaker as he was as a comic book character, is still fictional. So I wanted to make sure that people, you know, understood that, like, the real Black Panther Party, let's not confuse the two, because those are two different agendas.
Yeah, we're talking talking to Dr. Ramsey about that, and I think it's kind of surprising that people thought this had something to do with the Black Panther Party.
I did. I'm guilty.
You did too?
In the beginning, I did think, I'm like, oh, Black Panther, so they're kind of using the Black Panther Party and you know, some type of tribute or something.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, I wasn't a comic girl, so I need this.
And a lot of people are not comic book enthusiasts or readers. So the, you know, commercially, the name that they know, Black Panther, the first thing that's going to come to mind is the Black Panther Party, thus the confusion. So it was just a simple post. I just wanted people to know the difference between the two, A and B. I thought it's important to understand culturally how significant this movie really is. It's not just a comic book movie. This is a cultural phenomenon at this point. We need something like this that talks about inclusion. This film has, you know, it's African Americans, it's Africans, it's women. It talks about family. It talks about tradition. It talks about the pain that sometimes we feel within a family. It talks about a lot of different things that I think a lot of people can relate to. And shout out to Ryan Coogler, the director. I've been a fan since Fruitvale Station, and this is going to be really huge for him. So.
Wow.
You know, that's why I think it's going to touch a lot of people.
Wow.
Yeah. So break down the storyline of Black Panther. So what's going
Black
on?
Black Panther.
About loss.
Let's talk about the character himself. Basically, Marvel Comics in the 60s came up with a comic book character, Stan Lee, and an artist named Jack Kirby, came up with a character that they thought would be appropriate for the time. He was African. He was African. But he wasn't a sidekick. He wasn't a token or, you know, a helper. That's what we had up until that point. We didn't really have a standalone African-American character to go right alongside a Captain America or an Iron Man or, you know, the Fantastic Four. So he made his first appearance in 1966. Jack Kirby really created the character. Funny story. Originally, it was going to be called the Cold Tiger. Instead of the Black Panther.
Oh, wow.
A Cold Tiger. And they had this whack costume that they had come up with. And Stan Lee was like,
man,
nah.
This man really knows his history on this.
Wait a minute.
It's crazy. But I was a kid and
like
I was
Tony
into
the
that.
Tiger? Did it look like the Frosted Flake?
No, he had almost the same thing, but
now,
he wasn't in black. It was like gray and yellow. It was like gray and yellow costume with a cape and this thing. And so that didn't really fly. So Stan Lee was like, nah, we gotta do something a little different. So they turned the costume gray, gave him claws on the hands and feet, and they kind of changed it up a little bit. Funny also, too, that the Black Panther Party, or the version of the Black Panther Party that most people know, started in 1966 also, 3 months after.
So who came
that.
First?
Black Panther came first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he came first. Now, there are some people who would dispute it on my blog post. There are people that are like, yo, man, you don't know your history because it was starting in Waukesha County, da 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 da. Well, I understand that, but I was born in Oakland in 1963. My mom and dad were part of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. So that's the Black Panther Party that really became popular, Huey Newton, and so that's what I know, and that became the more popular, you know. But, you know, if you want to be technical, it did start, you know, earlier than that. But the Black Panther comic book character preceded the Black Panther Party in Oakland by 3 months.
Wow. Okay.
So
now the film.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about it. What is the storyline? Do you know?
The storyline, I don't want to spoil it because a lot of people are going to see it today. But basically, the storyline picks up. You have to. I would advise people to go see Captain America: Civil War, which is a Marvel film that happened before.
Love that film.
You can see then that was really the first appearance of the character that we're going to see released into theaters today, and you could tell the response in the theaters then that he was going to be big. He was the response to him on, you know, the internet and in the theaters was like, yo, who is this dude right here? And that's you could tell then it was going to be what it is now. You know, so basically the storyline picks up from there. His father was killed in that movie. Prince T'Challa, who's played by Chadwick Boseman, has to now go back to his country. And rather than being a prince, he's now a king. So there is a conflict between being a king and a monarch and being a superhero. There are some internal family conflicts as well. And then on top of all of that, you have a villain who's trying to, inspire mayhem, I guess we could say, and his name is Ulysses Klaue. So I like to think of this as Game of Thrones for black folks.
Oh.
That's what we got. Okay. And that's what it's going to be. So it's going to be kind of cool.
But you it's talked not just, a bit. Okay, go
you
ahead.
You talked a bit about this this world that they invented. So mm-hmm. How did Wakanda get its wealth, and how did they become so technologically advanced?
Wakanda is was actually a standalone nation. A meteorite crashed into Wakanda. The story goes 10,000 years ago or so. That meteorite was composed of a material called vibranium. It's an alien material, basically. And if you kind of look throughout history, there have been these big meteorite crashes in different places, Germany, Canada. Well, this one happened to land in Wakanda. And what it did was it did two things. It affected everything around it with the radiation that it emitted. So it affected the plants and the plant and animal life. And if you ever read the comic books, you'll see that mutation has caused problems and even caused adversaries for the Black Panther were created from that crash. But it also produced a plant, a heart-shaped herb called the heart-shaped herb. They didn't even try to be, clever about mm-hmm. it. And if you ingest that, there's a ruling body that rules Wakanda. They worship the panther god. The same way in ancient Egypt, the way they worship different deities. Mm-hmm. Well, they worship the panther god. If you are a part of this, it's passed down through the generations that the Black Panther is the protector of the people. Just imagine if the Pope had a costume and he protected the Vatican and the interests of the Vatican. Maybe he was a super cool dude, and he protected the interests of the Vatican. That's pretty much what the Black Panther is for Wakanda, for Africa. The panther god that they worship is really a goddess.
A goddess. Uh-huh. Okay.
And so
okay.
That's why, also in this film, you will see that women have a very significant role, unlike the usual, male dominated superhero films where the women are strong, like the Black Widow or Scarlet Witch. But in this situation, the women are a very important part of Wakandan culture. I mean, the Dora Milaje are a group of women who protect the king and the royal family. It's all female, and they are some bad fighters. Wait till you see the movie, man. They're gonna be whipping stuff. Wait till y'all see, it's crazy. Like if you saw Captain America: Civil War, and you saw that one confrontation with the Black Widow where she said, "I love doing this part. Move, or you will be moved.
Move, or you will be moved."
As entertaining as that would be.
Oh,
that lets you know what's happening. She was not even, she didn't even, and Black Widow was like, it's like it's in a club. She didn't even move. She didn't even.
She was fine too. It was like,
it's gorgeous.
It's changing these standards of beauty. We got different mohawks, short hair, right. Beautiful dark skin, wide noses, black skin. It was, you got Lupita Nyong'o, aka Bae. Lupita Pongo is what I call her.
My man.
Who are some of the actors in the film?
You have Academy Award winners. You have Angela Bassett. Obviously Chadwick Boseman, who's one of my favorites. He's a guy that takes a character and really makes it his own. He was great in 42. He was outstanding as James Brown. You have Sterling K. Brown, who's super huge right now. A lot of these actors signed on for this movie even before there was a script. That's how much they believed in what's happening now. They knew it was going to be big. So, that's really kind of what you have going with that,
All right. So you're going to check the film out today.
Yes. Three times. If I can squeeze it in.
Wow.
I have two invitations, and I had to beg for another one. And then Sunday I'm going to another event. And the reason for me, that this is really so important. When I was a kid, it was tough to find heroes that had our faces. And I'm just being real about it. When I was growing up, John Shaft came out. And he was all in black leather, and he was the coolest dude on the planet. Mother, shut your mouth. And he was so super cool. So that's what we had to look, that's kind of the really some of the only choices we had. So to see this come to fruition
this
today.
This is great for our youth now.
Absolutely.
They absolutely have someone to look up to. And it's just, this is for years to come.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Walmart, Target, y'all should see, like, Walmart. If you guys are looking for Black Panther stuff, Walmart, for real, has, like, this, has the most Black Panther merchandise right now. Mm. Like, I was like a kid. They got these claws that you can put on, and they got a mask, and it's crazy.
Wow.
But, you know, that's the importance of the movie. I don't want it to be, you know, I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that even though it's an African-American mm-hmm. helmed film and it's about Africans, this is a mainstream film.
Yes, it is.
And you have some criticism out there now. Oh, well, if you're giving your money to this, you're giving it to Disney. I got news for you. If you buy a candy bar out of a vending machine, you're giving it to somebody
now,
who's probably not Black.
Now, do you think this film will be beneficial for the community?
Absolutely. What it, again, it shows, because it, the film is so steeped in African culture and it shows intelligence, it shows beauty, it shows interaction, familial interaction, mm-hmm. a lot of the things that we in our African American communities were really lacking. You know, the family unit is really has always been kind of been a struggle for us. Well, this kind of shows the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. This shows, you know, about the family. This shows that you can go to Oxford University and get a PhD if you want to. This shows that, you know, they're flying around in spaceships, man, and you know, in an African country. This shows that you can be anything that you want to be, and it's really just up to you to do it. That's where I think it's going to be important for communities and our communities. And
just to show how to support one another.
Man, and a lot of the comments that I've been getting on my post on Facebook, I mean, literally, my phone keeps pinging. Mm-hmm. It's been pinging nonstop since yesterday. But I'm getting comments in languages I can't even read.
Wow.
This is like India. Asia.
That's amazing.
I've never experienced anything like this in my life, to be very honest. It's really hard for me not to, like yesterday I almost cried. Like it was such an amazing experience that God, you know, God sometimes will put you in a position.
He puts all of us
to affect other people.
Yeah.
And just what's happening, I can't believe it. I really cannot believe this.
Well, we talked about how it's going to affect the community, and the trickle-down effect in some ways is this sharing of creative space. So now that you have, just like we saw a lot of Black commentators during President Obama's era, after he left office, a lot of those people lost jobs.
Sure,
like,
absolutely.
On a lot of these shows. But they had jobs for those 8 years. And so now we have critics like a Kevin Ross, who never before had this opportunity, but having a chance to explain and kind of translate this film for people creates a new space for Black thought.
Absolutely.
When it comes to you know, we talked about Afrofuturism or sci-fi and
mm-hmm.
things that everyone's interested in but has been dominated in large part in art by white spaces. And
mm-hmm.
I even think about the presidential portraits.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk in a moment to
absolutely
Pat Keenan. And now you have Black art critics talking about art in general. They know Picasso mm-hmm. just as well as they know Amy Shepard.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, these types of things create space for us where we don't see enough black faces. So.
Or conversation. We don't have enough conversation about things that we're not familiar with. It's almost like we're afraid of it, you know. What I love about this also is that there are some people who never read comic books and they said, man, your post helped me understand what I'm going to go see. You know, Malcolm X said, don't ever get involved with something that you're not, of an organization you're not familiar with. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that about, you know, life in general. Like, before you go to see something, try to read about it or study about it, you
That's
know?
That's right. That's right. Because all of us know about the hype. Like, okay, Black Panther is coming out, but a lot of us did not know, like, okay.
The backstory or whatever.
Yeah.
Or really, again, how significant it was in 1966 for a mainstream comic book company to create a character like that. They came under fire for that.
Wow.
You know?
And it's so crazy because I didn't even...
Sorry, guys.
You said the phone was going off. That was the New York Times.
I knew it was happening, man.
That's them.
That was the New York Times.
Yeah, so I didn't even know that he was created in 1966. I saw a cup at home with my kids, and it had all the superheroes on there, and I saw Black Panther on there. I said, hey, wait a minute. So he's been around for a while. That's awesome. How can people find you, Kevin?
People can find me. I'm on Instagram at KRossChicago. My marketing company is at Two Guard Media Group on Instagram. And my event company with my business partner, Anita Bennett, is at A2 Marketing. And on Facebook, Kevin E. Ross. And Facebook, Tugar Media Group, music, business, and brand marketing. I know that's a lot, huh?
No,
it's just
like
enough.
That's like a receipt that comes out at the grocery store. That's a whole bunch of stuff.
And as your post says, as of today, well, a few days ago, the movie had pre-sold more tickets than any other superhero film in history.
Absolutely.
And it currently carries a critic's rating of 95% positive, which
right.
is almost unheard of.
And that's all. That's critics of all races. That's not just African American or not. I mean, we're talking about the New York
That's
Times,
right.
you're talking about Variety Magazine, Entertainment Weekly, The Post. I mean, it's really big.
That's right. So that means that anyone can go see this film, because I know there were a lot of people who was just like, well, can I go see it? That was not African American. Anyone can go see
this
film.
This movie is for everybody.
Is
it's
for
not
everyone.
Just for black people. And
That's
it's
right.
not, a, it's not Malcolm X, you know, this is for everyone to see.
I just want to say this real quick. I just want to voice how frustrating it is, though. Imagine if black people said, oh, can we go see Wonder Woman?
Right.
Can I go see Wonder Woman if I'm not a
right.
woman? Can I
right.
go see Superman yeah. if I'm not a white
is,
man?
Is it cool for me to watch Game of Thrones if I'm not white?
This
you
is
know,
so
it's
bizarre.
It's crazy. That's
why
what I. That's why it's crazy
black
to me. Yeah,
media,
that's crazy.
We gotta
to me.
Ask
right.
This. It's yes. the weirdest
you know, thing. I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan. You know.
Right.
So I you know, now Lord of the Rings. That's a whole different story. I'm not into all that. That stuff is crazy. You know. But. This is a movie for everyone. Again, the themes are universal, and that's what's important to understand.
Beautiful thing. His name is Kevin Ross. Look him up on Facebook. Get a chance to check out the post and comment in English, please, so he can read it, all right?
Yeah, really. Well, you know, they have the translate button now on Facebook.
They
Thank
do.
God, because I had someone from Egypt write me this whole big, long thing, and I didn't even know what, like, I was
wow.
like, okay, I did the translate
Egypt.
Button. So it's cool, though.
That's amazing. That's
Thank
amazing.
You so much.
Thank
next
you
up,
so much.
We continue the conversation
that's
on
right.
black art. Next up, we talk to Pat Keenan, who's going to break down the significance of the presidential portraits of Shapi. And to help us better understand the significance of those presidential portraits drawn by two African-American artists for the first time is Pat Keenan. Now, I know Pat as a PR professional, a PR pro, decades of experience, but I also know her as a great art enthusiast and art collector, and someone who just has a great grasp of what's happening, not only in the world of African-American art, but art in general. But she's the person whose home collection could rival that of anyone. I put my money on that, but I appreciate you for taking the time. She's in LA right now, but had an opportunity to call in and tell us about your thoughts on Amy Shepard's work and Kehinde's work. And again, thank you for jumping on Shopedia.
Amy Sherrill's work probably about 3 years ago at Expo Chicago. And I think for Chicagoans, it's real important to know, too, that one of her first major exhibits actually happened in Chicago. And she was recognized by the National Portrait Gallery after an exhibit that she had here. And I just found it really interesting. I took a lot of pictures of it myself. But what jumps out at me is that I would expect Michelle Obama to make a very informed choice. She's going to know what kind of artist she's dealing with. She's going to know what kind of work they do. And she also had consultants. She worked with Thelma Golden from the Studio Museum of Harlem and others. So I think on Michelle's part, she made a very conscious choice of who she wanted to do this work and understood the kind of output that she was going to get.
Now, what do you think drew Michelle Obama to Amy Sherrill's work? And forgive me, I've been calling her Amy Shepard because I have a friend of the same name. So every time I accidentally say Amy Shepard, but Amy Sherrill, what do you think drew Mrs. Obama to Amy Sherrill's work?
Well, again, I think it has an edge to it. It represents, just as Kehinde Wiley's work does, it represents everyday people. When you look at, and I put out something on Facebook about it as well, to show some of her work. When you look at it, it's the everyday people. You see, you know, people that look like your aunt or your cousin. You know, they aren't famous people. They're people, you know, wearing hoodies. They're girls wearing dresses. They're women with hats. I think, you know, again, the Obamas were very conscious about elevating African Americans, that we're important no matter who we are and no matter what we do. So that really jumped out at me when I, you know, having seen her work and then having seen, you know, Mrs. Obama's portrait. You know, there are people fishing and people with their kids. So it's very much about elevating African Americans and giving them a vision and a voice and a presence in art.
And what's amazing about this is that how much traction it caught on social media. So people, people were criticizing Amy's picture of Mrs. Obama because, you know, Mrs. Obama has this beautiful brown, vibrant skin, but Amy's style is muted colors, this gray that she had decided to put Mrs. Obama in. Some people are interpreting it as the first lady being above and beyond color, or that her color, her race doesn't necessarily matter, shouldn't be the focal point. Is that what that interpretation should be from your perspective, or do you think that this is just Amy's style and she continued with the common thread of what it is that she does?
I think it's a common thread of what she does. Again, I encourage people to go to her website. It's Amy Sherald, HERALD.com. Look at her work. And the portrait that she has done of Mrs. Obama is very in keeping with her aesthetic. Artists have aesthetics. And I think when you come to an artist, you look at their work, you look at their aesthetic, and you decide, is this the person for me, for what I want to achieve? And I think Mrs. Obama was, I think she was very in sync with that. So, again, there could be some social commentary here, and I think it would be amazing to be able to talk with Amy about this. We were actually talking about we should host something where we can have some conversation about this. But again, I think she chose her for her aesthetic, the way she represents people. And again, I love how, you know, when you look at the dress, the gown that Mrs. Obama is wearing, you know, it has some leanings toward, you know, quilting patterns, some things that are African diasporic. So I think all of those things are incorporated. But again, I think it's really about the aesthetic of the artist and how the subject, Mrs. Obama in this case, links up with the aesthetic of the artist.
Right. Let's swing it over to Kehinde Wiley's painting of President Obama, which also has some African influences. Like, for example, the African blue lilies comes from that Obama's Kenyan heritage. And you see those in the painting. You see him against the backdrop of these flowers. Now, part of Kehinde's aesthetic has always been placing people in different settings. Like he might put an African-American atop Napoleon's horse or put people in different settings where it gives them power and shows strength. But he put Obama in more of, he gave him a serious face, a more, I guess, cerebral look on his face. Looks like he's pensive, looks pretty stern, but against this floral backdrop that's much softer. Mm-hmm. Talk to a bit about Kehinde's aesthetic and what you believe may have drawn Barack to his work.
Again, I think with Kehinde, his work is very heroic. He looks at African Americans and says, we could be in these settings. We weren't given the opportunity to be kings and princes and shown in these ways, but we really are. So let me show you people in these heroic settings. And I think from what I've read, again, there was a lot of conversation between he and Barack. Barack's like, I can't be seen sitting on a throne on a horse. So he asked him to tap that down notch.
What I was always struck by whenever I saw his portraits was the degree to which they challenged our conventional views of power and privilege.
But again, Kehinde has taken everyday African Americans and put them in these heroic settings. So how wonderful was that for him to have someone who has been heroic, like Barack has been, being the first African American, and put him in this setting? You talked about the Kenyan lilies. The chrysanthemums are the Chicago flower. And also we have flowers from Hawaii that represent Hawaii. So, again, you hear the collaboration between the artist and the subject. You know, these are the things that are important to me. Kehinde's work has just, you know, gone off the charts over the years. You see him everywhere. I was at Art Basel this past December, and he did this humongous painting of Nick Cave, who's another Chicago artist. So I just love the associations that Chicago has to this, you know, Amy having done her first major show in Chicago and all of these things. So nothing else, it has made us think, it has made us talk, it has made us have conversations about art.
Talk to us about, lastly, how these paintings square up against paintings of previous first families. You sent over a picture. I'm looking at Kennedy's, JFK's portrait. That was a bit abstract, a little bit. It had this, you guys can definitely check it out, but George W. Bush's painting was much less abstract. It's just him in an office. Typically, previous presidents have these portraits where it just shows them, maybe with a token that means something significant to them, but they're much simpler, and they kind of look like they're painted so with so much realism, you think at first glance looking at some of them that they were actual pictures and not portraits or paintings.
Absolutely.
How different is this first family's portrait compared to previous ones?
Well, it definitely is. I went back and I even looked at George Washington's, and his was very epic. You know, I could see Kehinde Wiley having done George Washington. It had artifacts. It had him pointing. It had him in that very heroic stance. And I'm sure when Kehinde Wiley was coming up, he probably saw things like that to influence his work. Then you get to Carter. Carter broke the mold by wearing a beige suit instead of a dark suit. They thought that was very different for the time. And then you come forward, you show Kennedy, and it was a very contemporary kind of abstract painting. I believe Elaine Jasper, or I can't remember her name right now, that did that painting. Clinton's looked like a mosaic. So there have been periodically through time presidents who sought to kind of break the mold. It's just the Obamas broke it so spectacularly, I think. I like to call it artistic creative dissonance. You know, we have this idea in our head about what a portrait should be, but they've come along and said, it doesn't have to be that. It can be different. And so now we're trying to square these two ideas in our head, one that's traditional with one that's outside the box. And again, I just think it's a wonderful thing.
Pat Keenan is an art collector, a PR pro, and a good friend of mine who I've actually had a chance to go on different art tours. Were you at the Diaspora Rhythms tour that I went on?
I have. I've known Patrick for a couple of years now and been able to see his work. And then I'm heading out to the Harlem Fine Arts Show tomorrow for their annual show in New York. So it's something I learn about every day, and I just totally enjoyed it. So, yeah.
And so she will be talking to us again pretty soon, because as far as the Harlem Fine Arts Show goes, we definitely want to elevate that on Shopedia. We'll actually have in the link to this post on WGNRadio.com on the Shopedia page, we'll have some information about an upcoming event in regards to the Harlem Fine Arts Show. One of my favorite artists, Martha Wade, is showing work right now in New York. David Anthony, James Nelson, just a few names of some fantastic artists here in Chicago who are still young, but are really making waves that will last centuries. I'm sure of it. So
yes, and be on the lookout. We're coming down the pike with some other arts things that we're doing, and we want to have some discussion about this. So I've talked to a couple of people to just have a conversation about this work in Chicago. So I'll let you know as soon as we work out the details on that as well.
Lastly, where can they find you, and where can they find more information about upcoming events and initiatives?
Absolutely. My company is the Tallulah Group, TallulahAH. So look us up, TallulahGroup.com online. And you can always reach me at 312-206-2821.
That is Pat Keenan. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And every good movie ends with some sort of love story. And of course, our movie Black Panther that we've been talking about is no different. This is Valentine's
I'm
Day
all
week.
About love and Valentine.
Absolutely. And Marsha had a chance to talk love with one of the writers of some of our favorite love songs.
That's right. I was able to check out Case last week, actually, just in time for Valentine's Day.
Let's get a quick look at that conversation.
Who are you rocking with nowadays? Who are you vibing with?
As far as the new people, it's in the future. Daniel Caesar, Jasmine Sullivan, H.E.R. But now, I still listen to old stuff. I listen to Motown all the time.
Okay.
Sly and Family Stone, The Beatles, all that type of stuff. So.
Okay, all right. Now, weren't you a part of a group called Future at one point?
Yeah, but that was way.
That was
you took the wrong back.
I took it back.
She went all the way back.
So before there was was Future, you was a part of the group.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. It was a duo. Yeah.
All right. So is there anybody right now that you would like to collaborate with?
Yeah, actually, I'm working on something that I think I'm going to do with Daniel Caesar for this new album.
Daniel Caesar? Yeah. Okay. So we know that you've done a lot of music on soundtracks. Do we foresee anything coming in the future? Nope. Nothing? Are you done with soundtracks?
All the reason it was on in the first place is because... I'm putting you on to a secret. What happens is I did the records already. It was for my album. But if you put it on the soundtrack, they pay for half the promotion, so I don't have to pay for that.
Is that how that works?
That's how it ended up on the soundtrack.
Oh, okay.
Since we homies, I'm going to tell you that.
We are homies.
Yeah.
All right, of course. I was in love with Case when I was in high school. We had Faded Pictures. We had Happily Ever After. Do you think that R&B right now is a dying genre?
No, I don't think it's dying. I think everything goes in circles. And I think that for a minute it was kind of fading away, but it's coming back around. Like everything does, fashion, music, everything, it comes back in circles. So it's coming back. I'm going to be a part of it coming back.
Okay. So any advice that you would have for any inspiring talent right now?
I think it's a few things. I think the first thing is to realize that the music business is a business first. Mm-hmm. Music comes second. Uh-huh. Secondly, have a vision of what they want to be, who they want to be, what they want to say, what they want to look like, and stick to it, because there's going to be a lot of people that have their own ideas of what you should say, what you should make, and stuff like that. So you should stay true to yourself, definitely.
Okay. So what about there's a lot of ups and downs in the industry, correct?
Well, that's life.
That's life.
It's ups and downs in life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you ain't ready for that, then you're ready for nothing.
Marsha out in the streets, catching her in traffic as always.
Man, I was in love with Case when I was in high school. So to be able to meet an artist like him, and I listened to his songs. I mean, he had a few hits, of course, we know, Touch Me, Tease Me. And in fact, they're doing a remake of that. Diddy's son.
Oh, that's right.
He's remaking it. So using that same beat of Touch Me, Tease Me, now they're bringing it back around. So as you heard Case say, R&B isn't gone. It has a way of, you know, leaving and coming back. Certain music we tend to sample, and this is one of them.
And the Facebook Live video of Marsha out there, and you know, snippets from his performance, pictures of her with Case, actually a video of that interview, snippets of it, can be found on our Instagram page at Shypedia, of course, Chipedia podcast. Again, that's Shypedia podcast on Instagram. And if you like what you've heard, shoot us some comments.
All right. And be sure to follow us on our personal pages as well.
Yeah. My page is Doma T, D-O-M-E-T-I _.
See who Doma T is. And mine's is Marsha _Marsha, the number 2.
Yes. Marsha 2 times. Say it 2 times.
That's
Marsha
right.
_Marsha 2. Marsha, Marsha. You are listening to Doma T at Marsha, Marsha. This has been another episode, a page out of the Shypedia book. Until next Friday.
Thank you for tuning in.